For the Wild podcast is brought to you in part by the Calliopeia Foundation and listeners like you. Calliopeia supports projects interweaving spirituality, culture, and ecology. We are grateful for their support and the support of grassroots contributions from listeners. To learn more about the Calliopeia Foundation, visit calliopeia.org. To make a donation to For the Wild, visit forthewild.world/donate or support us through Patreon.
Hey, For the Wild community, it's Ayana here. Before we begin the show, I wanted to take a moment to talk about our Patreon. We are so grateful to all of the amazing members of our community who contribute to bringing this podcast to life each week. We couldn't do this work without you. To keep For the Wild freely accessible to all, long-term we're exploring how we can fund the podcast without resigning ourselves to overly commercializing our airtime in order to sustain production. We believe that independent media plays an essential role in telling the truth outside of corporate agendas, and we want to be in integrity as much as possible with how we support this work. We need your help with this. Community support goes a long way to help us advance these goals. We have around 500 Patreon members currently, and we are dreaming into a goal for our Patreon community to grow to 2,000 supporting members in the upcoming months. We'd love to have you join with us. We're operating under a pay-what-you-can model over there, so you can sign up for as little as $1. Join us at patreon.com/forthewild. And if you're already supporting us in one way or another, we want to thank you so much and wish you a beautiful season wherever you are. Hello, and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today, I'll be speaking to world-renowned environmental thinker and activist, Dr. Vandana Shiva.
Economy as the care of our home. Economy as the art of living, not economy as Wall Street or the billionaire's logic of extraction.
Vandana is a leader in the International Forum on Globalization and of the Slow Food Movement. Director of Navdanya and of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, and a tireless crusader for farmers, peasants, and women's rights. She is the author and editor of a score of influential books, including her latest from Chelsea Green Publishing, Oneness versus the 1%. Well, Vandana, thank you so much for joining me in conversation again. I'm truly looking forward to this, so welcome.
Pleasure to be talking again.
So I'd like to start our conversation in recognition of what you call compassionate courage. In the Movement for Earth, your voice has remained one of the very few that has not succumbed to big green or the commodification of environmentalism. But instead, time and time again, you speak to the crises of our time, a crisis of illusions in which we refuse to confront our penchant for destroying life. And this to me is so rare because lately it feels the more traction climate and environmental movements gain, the more watered down they become. So I have this question swirling around courage and direct action and how we can awaken others to the necessity of direct action, and how have you remained unwavering in your commitment to speak truth to power, even when it means standing up to those who were once at your side? What does compassionate courage mean amidst late-stage capitalism?
Well, compassionate courage actually means the same no matter what time you live in, except that at the end of an age of colonialism, which named itself capitalism, because all the wealth that was accumulated was not from the miracle of money, it was from the violence of land grab, resource grab, genocide. And it just got structured in a system which said land is dead, labor doesn't produce, capital is a miraculous creator of things. Compassionate courage becomes even more important when we are not just ruled by these illusions, but there's an intolerance of the illusion makers to truth. So compassionate courage then means standing by your truth and living by your truth, and non-cooperation with illusions, constructs that create the billionaires, that create the inequalities, that even create the pandemics, because why would the most amazing wilderness of the world, Amazon, be burning if it wasn't for money to be made from GMO soy? So the illusion of a patent, the illusion of money making, the illusion of genetic engineering as a superior system, the illusion of now impossible burger as a way to save the planet, not cooperating with these illusions is compassionate courage. And it comes from recognizing that we are one with all beings on the earth. And that is a state of being wild. Because if the wild is nature in her freedom and her diversity and her beauty and her unfolding, then us being part of that means reclaiming our wildness, which means reclaiming our interconnectedness with other life and realizing other life is sentient.
Yes, I really agree with you. And you're right, the compassionate courage comes from our understanding that the world is interconnected. Our shared sense of interconnectedness emboldens our courage. Now, in the country in which I'm speaking to you, I feel many listeners may be disappointed to see that many members of our planetary community have detached themselves from the sense of interconnectedness, remaining deeply committed to an extractive and individualistic mindset. And in a settler societies like the United States, I think about how this is emboldened by our obsession and obligation to the so-called nuclear or patriarchal family. So much so that we have fundamentally lost our understanding of our larger family, or the world as family. So why is the disavowal of patriarchal structures necessary in order to retain a sense of interconnectedness?
Well, you know, there have been many kinds of patriarchies, but not in all societies all the time. Even Europe really got patriarchy in the last few thousand years. Before that, the feminine was at the center. And in the old archaeological sites, they don't find weapons of war. They find the divine goddess. In indigenous cultures, even today, there is no patriarchy. So patriarchy married to money-making, which becomes capitalist patriarchy, is really taking to very, very violent systems at the structure level and making them even more, amplifying their violence and their structural linkages. So if you think of it, who's the individual in this capitalist patriarchal structure? A man, a property-owning man. Can you imagine if instead of this, if the unit was the earth family or the community, as indigenous cultures have always seen their identity, you wouldn't have resource grabbing, you wouldn't have genocide, you wouldn't have privatization of land, of biodiversity, of seed, and you would not accept the harm done to your fellow relatives, whether the relatives are plants and other animals or other cultures. So at the heart of the myths of what is called capitalism, but I call it colonialism, it's continuation of colonialism, which is very masculine in form, which is very patriarchal in form. At the heart of it is denying the life in nature, therefore the life of all our relatives in nature, and denying women's capacities to produce, to create, by saying this is not production and creation. If you know through nonviolence in partnership and co-creation, it's declared as not knowledge. As Bacon said, we have to torture nature. We have to subjugate her into slavery. That idea is 400 years old. And colonialism is about 500 years ago. So these structures of separation, of fragmentation, of illusion of superiority, of the settlers and the occupiers and the colonizers over those they colonize, or anthropocentrism, the superiority of the human species over other species, all of these were necessary constructs to invade and grab and extract. And we begin by recognizing that we are members of one earth family. We begin by recognizing that respect for all life and respect for women and respect for the indigenous and the respect for the small farmer and the respect for the workers is one respect based on recognizing that they are the true creators of wealth. They are the true creators of knowledge.
In Oneness Versus the 1%, you point out that we are living in times where, quote, the 1% controls the wealth and power to destroy our planet and our common lives, with no responsibility or accountability for their actions, because they have found clever ways to create illusions, end quote. This illusory spell that so many have found themselves under feels like it's been generations in the making. And I'd like to ask you, what is the illusion and how are we actually complicit when we refuse to dispel it? Or perhaps, why do you think the global majority has proven itself so dedicated to upholding a system of the elite?
You know, as someone commented, do you really mean 1%? I said, no, I mean 0.0001%, except that it looks very ugly on a book cover. And 1% as subsuming that very tiny number who, as you notice in the data, the technology barons walked away with nearly $1 trillion, while people lost their homes, they lost their food, they lost their work, they lost their livelihoods. And more people are dying of hunger today than of COVID. This is from the World Food Program, this is from Oxfam, this is from anywhere where data is still taken. So illusion number one, that nature is dead, inert raw material and capital creates. Nature creates. And anything we create with her is based on her creativity. Capital extracts. Capital itself is an illusion. Because the word, its Latin roots, is caput, yeah, which used to mean heads of cattle, and that's a real wealth. But it also means finished. Giving capital creative power, a construct creative power, is the first illusion. And because so much of what people had has been taken away from them, and they've been made dependent on the money machine, they really think that if you have more growth, maybe we have a little bit of chance that we'll have bread on our table. And that's why there isn't a rebellion against the bailout, like there wasn't a rebellion in the 2008 bailout with the financial collapse. These trillions that are being given are being just harvested by the billionaires. The second illusion is that corporations are persons. You know, colonialism mutated into capitalism through the East India Company. And the East India Company took the 300 rogues of England, merchant adventurers they were called, put them together in a group. And basically, they took the power to invade our lands, my country in particular, which is why they were called East India Company, but also to have limited liability. So if the ships carrying our spices reached home, it was their wealth. The 300 divided it amongst themselves. But if the Dutch East India Company got it, or the French got it, then society had to pay for it, and they still made money. So limited liability was the beginning of a system where they never lost. It was a socialization of the risk and the privatization of the gains. And now they are moving into basically a zero cost economy. They call it zero cost, where they'll have no liability of any kind. New illusions of our times. I've just released a book this evening before I came to talk to you in India. It is called Two Futures of Food, Health, and Humanity. And it was triggered by three patents. One, a patent on Impossible Burger and fake lab-made breast milk in the name of saving, protecting the earth from climate change. Bill Gates is everywhere these days. The second is on nanoparticles introduced in our blood for iron deficiency in anemia, when all I need to do is take a few leaves of the sahajan, we call it, the moringa leaves, or turmeric. And they can provide you all the iron, all the green leaves. So I put that together and said, here are all the alternatives that nature gives us. And here is a violent invasion created by Google through a new life sciences division, 5 years old. You know, they're taking on thousands of years of knowledge that humanity has evolved about our bodies and our health. And a five-year-old company made with the motto that we must defeat Mother Nature. They want to put untested nanoparticles into our metallic nanoparticles. And the third, the patent on the human body, mining our data, our brain data, our body data. So, you know, my work has been guided so much by the beginning with Monsanto and others wanting to patent seed. That is an illusion, because a patent is an exclusive right to what you have invented. A seed is not invented by Monsanto. Our bodies are not invented by Microsoft. Invading our bodies is not an invention. It is an invasion. And Google should totally be prohibited from doing this. And Gates wanting to have the Impossible Burger and take patents on it with GMO soya, blood made in the lab, and calling it a healthy diet. And he calls real food, Bob Brown calls it unimprovable technology. Real food is unimprovable technology. Our bodies are unimprovable technologies. Invasions, violence, takeover is superior technology. And I have written repeatedly in my book, Oneness versus 1%, as you will have noticed, if the first colonization used religion as the civilizing mission, the contemporary colonization of the earth, of the wild, of our bodies, of our self-organization, of our freedom, is using technology as the new religion for a civilizing mission. And what it is pitted against is the freedom of life as self-organized, which to me is what wild is, against slavery in old forms and new forms, and patenting is at the heart of slavery. Columbus set sail with a letters patent. Monsanto took patents on seed. And now the big tech is taking patents, not just on software where they got rich, but now on our bodies and living organisms. And this is the wake up for humanity. And this is where people of concern need to be responding. You know, you talked about big environmentalism. The reason it lost courage and it lost compassion is because it started to be driven too much by money. And when you're too dependent on money, you have to listen to the messages and instructions of the masters. But when you are inspired by nature, by the wild, you listen to the instructions of the earth. And that gives you courage.
Wow, Vandana, that was a frightening response and also very empowering at the same time. You know, what I've noticed over the years is that when we talk about the perils of technology, it's through a very individualistic framing. You know, we discuss the implications of social media on our mental health in terms of anxiety and depression, or we talk about the attention spans of future generations, but less are we holding conversations about the implications of technology and our submission to it in terms of how we are setting ourselves up to become accessories to artificial intelligence and the digital world. And yeah, this is why I think your writing on how technology will subjugate us as a society is so vital to bring into consciousness. So I'm wondering if you could expand on what you were just speaking about with our listeners of how you think technology will restructure our capacity to survive in a sovereign manner.
When I started, I trained in physics, but I did a lot of interdisciplinary work in science and technology policy. And the discourse in the 70s and 80s used to be on science and technology assessment. We assess technologies. And when you assess a technology, the first question you ask is, do I really need it? The second question you ask is, how does it compare to existing alternatives? The third question you asked is, does it have any risks and hazards? And the fourth question you ask is, how does it serve nature? And how does it serve society? Now, all of the four cases I've addressed in the book, and I'll be very happy to send you the links, but you can look for Two Futures of Food, Health, and Humanity, published by Sissa and Navdanya, released today. And it is, from what I gather from my colleagues, already available in digital form. The three cases I've taken here, based on the patents these companies have applied, this is not coming out of my mind. This is reading their patents. Nanoparticles in our blood, necessary? No. Better than alternatives? Not compared to all the biodiversity we have. Risks? huge, unknown. They haven't even been assessed. And do they improve nature and society? No. They will create new diseases for which the same companies will have new miracles and new technological fixes. Or take breast milk, artificial breast milk in the lab. Is it necessary? No. All we have to do is make it easier for mothers to have situations where they can go away to breastfeed their babies. We need more creches in the workplaces. Anyway, now they've made all work from home. Superior lab milk, superior, no. Risks assessed, not at all. And does it improve the wholesomeness of our bodies, of the baby's health? We know for sure the reason the baby food, the movement against baby food, the lactogen tins and the fabricated food was so strong is because the evidence was there that this causes harm. So we've got to bring technology back to where it belongs. It's a tool. It needs assessment. Societies must have choice. If assessment through democratic process and choice through democratic process and full informed consent is missing, then you are moving very quickly into the use of tools as dictatorships. Technology then becomes the tools in the hands of the masters rather than a tool at the service of nature and humanity. And those of us who worked in these fields for so long know that if I plant diversity in our fields, as I do with Navdanya, the movement I started, there will be lots of insects, but no pests. Diversity is a technology, but it's not a harsh technology. And I remember, this stays in my mind, 82, I was launching the organic movement of India, and we decided where else but to Gandhi's ashram, the non-violence prophets. And I'm going to be offering from the 1st to the 4th of November a course with Satish Kumar on non-violence and compassion as the most important political movement of our times. And people can go to the Earth University website of Navdanya, and they will find details of those courses. But coming back to the Gandhi ashram, you know, he had celebrated nonviolence, and I saw them using pesticides. And I said, how can you, in Gandhi's ashram, use pesticides? And they said, you know, we were very impressed. A French scientist came and sprayed pesticides, and the birds dropped dead and the insects dropped dead, and we were totally overwhelmed by the power. So violent power has brainwashed us. Violent power has taken away our capacity to live and think through creative power in nonviolent form. This is the power of the wild. This is the power of women. This is the power of indigenous people. This is the power if humanity has to have a future. This is the kind of power that the young people marching on climate change need to reclaim. Not panic, not march because of panic, but march because you love the earth so much that you're not going to let anything come in the way of preventing actions that are harming the earth, whether through extinction or through climate change or the pandemic or any of the other existential crises we face. Sometimes when we don't know the words we hum, sometimes when we don't know the words we hum.
I am so inspired by your sheer dedication and fearlessness and courage. It's really a necessary reminder for all of us who feel desensitized, discouraged by what's happening in the world. You just give us this spark of like fire again. And it just feels so, it feels so good to hear you say these things. And now you write, quote, "We must reclaim our real freedoms and not be seduced by the false freedoms of free trade, corporate rule, algorithm-run democracy, and consumerism. We must stand firm and reclaim the meaning of wealth and the conditions for being well," end quote. In a world where we are trained to consume, the call to reclaim our intellectual freedom is an act of resistance and a battle against addiction. And this leads me to think about the importance of active remembrance and looking at historical examples of freedom that we can revive. Now, personally, I'm wondering, what examples of freedom do you seed inspiration from, and how do you practice growing these memories into reality?
You know, as I mentioned, the East India Company was created to colonize India. Even Columbus set sail for India. That's why all the indigenous people of the Americas are called Indians. He thought he had landed in India for the spices, which was the big issue of that time. The East India Company basically, you know, wanted our textiles and our spices. They took the richest textile economy of the world and destroyed it. They colonized North America, took the land from the indigenous people by violence, because they grabbed so much land. And at that time, there was no fossil fuels, there was no mechanization. They had to capture Africans as slaves to do the cotton picking on these giant-sized plantations which they had grabbed. So the workers had been captured as slaves, the land had been captured and enslaved, and then with all of this cotton, they were able to use the fossil fuel industrialism to destroy textiles everywhere, dump clothing, machine-made clothing, and Gandhi then pulled out the spinning wheel and said, we will not be free till we reclaim our economic freedom. And if the empire of cotton is enslaving us, then we will make our own cloth. So when I realized the corporations were wanting to, the agrochemical poison cartel wanted to own life through patenting, through GMOs, I thought back to our history and I remembered that it was the spinning wheel that mobilized India's self-confidence that we could be free. It was in our power. No one was using spinning wheels at that time. They'd all been destroyed. We taught ourselves to spin. We taught ourselves to make handloom clothing again. And from nothing, we jumped back. About 20 years ago, I looked, 75% of our clothing came from hand-spun, hand-woven cloth. And beautiful textiles at that. So when I realized that the corporations wanted to own the seed, I took inspiration from the spinning wheel and said, the spinning wheel of today is the seed, because the empire of cotton has given way to an empire over life itself through trying to own life. And just like the spinning wheel is small, and because it's small, it can be in the hands of millions, the seed is small and can be in the hands of the poorest peasant. And this is what I've done through Navdanya the last 33 years. Defend the freedom of the seed and its wildness, because non-GMO seed is a wild seed. A non-hybrid, which does not breed true. You know, so hybrids don't breed true, but non-hybrids. Living seed is free seed. It is alive. It is wild. And when farmers co-create with that seed to make 200,000 rices in India from one grass, or thousands of corns in Mexico out of one teosinte, this too is wildness outside the apartheid. I call it the ecological apartheid, which said we are outside nature, the wild is nature, we are domesticated. No. When we are free, we are wild, because we are part of nature. When we are enslaved through fossil fuel technology or digital technology or toxic technology of the glyphosate and the Roundup and the pesticides, that's when we lose our freedom and our wildness. So the three things that have constantly inspired me in all the things I've done begin with the small, which is why I don't get panicky when big money isn't happy with what we do. The earth is happy. Diversify. Let many people do things in their own ways. And the third is self-organize. And for me, if there's one word that defines what is wild, it is that which is not controlled by the outside. It is wild. Self-organization is wilderness.
I'm really hanging on every word. This is so personally good for me to hear. So thank you for everything that you're saying. And I wanted to bring up that this past year, divisions have become amplified in many parts of the world. And I think many are contending with the reality that hatred is not easily wiped away. And the changing of ruling political parties does not remediate the hatred that has grown in the cracks of deepening inequalities. Now, you speak to the reality that social violence and disintegration is becoming the norm. And I'm curious to hear how you think we can operate amidst all of the hatred that our generation is being left to bear. How do we dismember the politics of hate that have become so pervasive?
I think there are three aspects of transcending this constructed hate. I call it constructed hate because it's not essential to human beings to hate. And it isn't in every period of history. That people who have had historical inequalities and injustices continue every moment to prevent that history from creating a new unity of humanity, a new unity of justice. Yeah. The civil rights movement in the United States overcame segregation, but not to create segregation. And so many people who were white joined the civil rights movement. Every law that was passed was because people united over the larger cause. Before I wrote Oneness versus 1%, I wrote Earth Democracy after Seattle because we were being repeatedly told, oh, the anti-globalization movement knows what it's against. It doesn't know what it's for. And I said, you didn't get it. We are against your free trade and against your globalization because we know we are for the biodiversity. We are for the earth. We are for people's livelihoods and jobs. We are for equality and justice, and we are for sovereignty and democracy. So I wrote Earth Democracy, and in that I have shown how a neoliberal deregulation of commerce, which is called free trade, robs people of their basic securities, their work, their livelihoods. It then fuels divisions. And the divisions then become the capital to keep fueling the money machine. I developed that further in Oneness versus 1%. So it isn't an accident that those who are billionaires were financing the hate vote of 2016. The same big money, instead of allowing people to unify on making sure everyone has work. Everyone has dignity. Everyone has access to healthcare. Everyone has access to good education, not being enslaved to a computer, but classrooms in the wild. You don't want people in a classroom? Okay, get them out of the cement, but don't lock them in with a computer. Let them roam in the forest. That too is a classroom. So these new enslavements are actually fueling new divides. And that is also the very big reason we always have to be very alert to see what is money driving society to. They control the media. They definitely control the social media. 2016, Facebook sold its data that it had stolen without your permission to Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica used four hates to turn into political messages: hate of women, hate of blacks, hate of Muslims, hate of migrants. So the 2016 election was an algorithm-run election. And as a Newsweek article said, and it elected an artificial intelligence president. So a lot of the divisions are being maintained and deepened because it suits the money-making machine that I talk about in Oneness versus 1%. It suits the billionaires and the super rich. When the British realized they couldn't stay in India because India rose against them, united across religions, in 1857, we drove the East India Company out. So what did the British do after that? They said, we have to divide and rule. And they started engineering immediately after hate between Muslims and Hindus. And if Pakistan was divided from India, it was through an engineering by the British rulers, thinking they could continue to stay on. But they left a divide that has not healed. The greed machine creates divide and rule. The love and compassion and the courage has to unite to know we are one humanity on one planet. There's no division. There's no separation. And that is where reclaiming our own autonomy comes into the picture, where we don't look at social media messaging. We look at experiences. We look at our relationships. We live freedom. We live our lives.
Through each conversation I hold on the podcast, I'm reminded of the inability of corporate governments to either provide us with meaningful leadership, change, or transition. And while the 20th century once held hopeful democratic uprisings, by now most of us feel stymied by visions of, quote, democracy, or fear that whatever semblance of democracy we once knew is now being eroded by the technological age. And I see this as a period where we must revitalize our understanding and practices of self-government. So I'm wondering if we can delve into the concept of Swaraj for listeners and how it fits into our larger movement for a way of living that does not seek to exterminate life itself.
Just like compassionate courage is relevant in each age, but becomes more relevant when systems of the economy or governance become more violent, in a similar way, self-rule, self-governance, self-organization is the only way for every being and every human being to live. And of course, the self-governance then spreads from the individual to the communities, to the local, to the regional, to the national, and to the planetary. So the word Swaraj, Raj is to rule, Swaraj means to rule through yourself, self-rule. And this was the word across the world at the time of British colonialism. Even in Hawaii, the word they used was self-rule and home rule. This is exactly the same principle as the principle of the seed being self-organized complexity in evolution. Like nature evolves in freedom through self-organization, true free societies evolve in freedom through Swaraj. And Swaraj also means not just understanding the limits of the market and the limits of a state married to a market, but having the compassionate courage to say no. And that is the civil disobedience. So I've had to practice it from the days of saying no to patents and seed, when the GM lobby wanted to dump GM soya on us and made our own edible oils and our cold press mills illegal. I had to march with my sisters for bringing back our oils. So I work on five freedoms that are related to our everyday lives and to the majority of our Indian people. Seed freedom, beet Swaraj. Food freedom, Anna is food, Anna Swaraj. Freedom of working with the earth as your mother, but protecting your right to work with her and therefore resisting land grab, Bhuswaraj, land sovereignty. Your knowledge sovereignty, Gyan Swaraj, and increasingly economic sovereignty, shaping your economies. Given that since the rise of colonialism, mutated into capitalism, mutated now into digital dictatorship, the option is always kill the economies of freedom of the people. Swaraj then becomes absolutely vital. And if you project, if you read this new book I've released today, and you project the patterns into the future. You know, I projected the patterns of that time into the future and said, no, I will not allow seeds to be patented. If you project those patterns into the future where we are reduced to users, algorithms define our value, and then we are assigned cryptocurrencies. Already in India, they made cash illegal, the big notes illegal. Don't be surprised if in a very, very short term, they make cash illegal across the world. And then cryptocurrencies, not governed by central banks, no reality, fixed by the algorithms of the fortech giants. Do we want to live in a world where our value is determined by those who've taken our value away? Do we want to live in a world where we don't have the freedom to go to the local farmers markets, where everyone is under surveillance? Surveillance capitalism is what Zuboff has talked about. So we need to project into the future the reality that they are talking about, that they are now putting into place, and say that path is not my Swaraj. My Swaraj is this path. That is democracy. And democracy, you know, representative democracy was never supposed to be democracy, but it was reduced to democracy. Participation in shaping your lives, what you eat, what you grow, how you trade, how your economies are, what those participatory systems are true democracy. And economic democracy is where all of these breakdowns will be addressed. When we reclaim our ability to define the economy as the care of our home, economy as the art of living, not economy as Wall Street or the billionaire's logic of extraction.
This body that we live in don't last long. This body that we live in we don't own. This body that we live in don't last long. This body. I'm jealous of the way the flowers grow. Even though hands still they shine, they still happen to know that the key in life is to be still, and also to know that the art of opening up is to learn to let go. Body that we live in, no, no. Body that we live in.
The analysis you just gave on cryptocurrency is not one that I have heard, and that's really frightening and important for us to look into deeper. So I've made a note for myself to dive into that a bit more, because I didn't even consider that cash would be taken away, and that's a whole other level. Well, I'd like to transition our conversation to discuss the ways in which corporations like Monsanto have been extending their grip into the world of data collection, which isn't nearly discussed enough. And why are corporations like Monsanto so interested in remote sensing technology, data collection, and forms of artificial false knowledge? How does this coincide with the calculated attempts at severing ancestral knowledge, and for lack of a better word, the dumbing down of our land tenders and seed keepers, which poses a significant threat to our ability to adapt amidst changing climate regimes?
When I wrote Oneness versus 1%, Monsanto had just announced its entry into digital agriculture. It had bought out the world's biggest climate data corporation and the world's biggest soil data corporation. And through remote sensing, what they are hoping to do is be the only people who can tell you what your soil is like and then prescribe to you their chemicals. They're not going to tell you. Feed the soil with organic matter and let the earthworms and the mycorrhizae bring life back, because they can't make money out of that. So the digital agriculture spin is, we will reduce chemicals by 1%. But in the process of drones and driverless tractors, they're going to create ever larger farms that will use ever more chemicals. The theme on Monsanto's website, and I've cited it in the book, was the future of farming is without farmers. So they don't just want to erode our knowledge. They want to make farmers disappear. And the Monsanto legacy, you know, Monsanto is now bought out by Bayer. The Monsanto legacy is being pushed ahead by Bill Gates, who appears to be the big philanthropist of our time. I have just released another report on the Gates to the Global Empire, on how he's taking over seed, agriculture, all the seed banks of the world, health, of course, the media, education, engineering the climate through geoengineering, and driving species to extinction through gene drives. But he is doing exactly what Monsanto said they would. And he's calling this his version of digital agriculture Gates Ag One. It was announced this January, just a little before the COVID. And he is announcing one model of agriculture for the entire world, controlled digitally. And there are already institutes like the ICRISAD, the Dryland Institute in India. They are signing contracts with Microsoft. So first they mine, just like the Microsoft patent application of 060606 is about mining our data and then assigning us value as cryptocurrency. They put people into farms to mine farming data, then put it into big data and process it through algorithms. And then Microsoft sells it back as big data. And that's the reason everyone's being given a smartphone. That's the reason Bill Gates had an agreement with Mr. Slim, the billionaire of Mexico. So the digital technologies, the poison technology, and big pharma and big finance are all coming together in the next grab. And if they manage it, there will be no life on earth. It is a recipe of fast-forwarding extinction. This is the reason we all need to wake up. If you're worried about species disappearance, wake up to this digital dictatorship. You're worried about climate change, wake up to this. If you're worried about democracy and freedom, wake up to this. No matter what your concern, it is being impacted and it is so invisible. And that's the reason I wrote the book. I really felt it was important for the people to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in this new edition of Oneness versus the 1%, you've updated it to acknowledge the role of Bill Gates, like you're mentioning, amidst the coronavirus pandemic, and how billionaires alike are making money off of disaster. And there have been many theories running rampant during this time, some of which it feels are being used to keep us distracted and disconnected. So from a clear voice, I'd like to ask you about what you're observing, what is being obstructed, and what are organizations like the World Intellectual Property Organization getting away with while our eyes are turned away?
Well, what's being obstructed is the ecological awakening that we are interconnected. What's being obstructed is that our health depends on our immunity. And the same virus can be floating around. But if your immunity is good, you will not be affected. And if you are compromised, you will be affected. If you have chronic diseases because of the junk food industry, it could become fatal. All of those linkages are being blocked. There are so many ways to treat a viral infection. Those pluralities are being blocked. What else is being blocked is an exploration of how, in the year 2020, when we know new pandemics are coming from the destruction of the wild, the invasion into forests, the violation of ecosystem boundaries of forest ecosystems, at that time, we should be looking at how do you stop this expansionism, and instead, you are being pushed into relentless expansionism. What is also being blocked is the exploration of a food system that doesn't cause disease and doesn't destroy the planet. My book, Soil Not Oil, I worked how 50% of the greenhouse gases come from industrial globalized food systems. And yet in ecological systems and regenerative agriculture, we have 100% solution, not just to the climate crisis, but to food and hunger. This is being blocked by financing Impossible Burger and making that look like the future of food as if it's already been determined. No, we need an amazing debate on what is food. Is that junk from a lab food? Is it worthy of being called food? Or is it just hyper-processed junk, which will increase the diseases because it will create a new war against our gut microbiome? And then, of course, finally, what's being blocked is our thinking. When we are turned into data minds, brain is mind, our bodies are mind, it means we as autonomous, intelligent decision makers get blocked. And that's why never before has humanity faced so many multiple challenges to its own species existence as we face today. And many of these are there in the WIPO offices, they're there in the patent offices, but most people don't read patents, but maybe they'll read the book and through the book, reclaim their oneness and get the power through that oneness with the earth, with the wild, with all other wild relatives, to say five technology barons cannot push us over the brink.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about, I think, the WIPO patent from March 26th of this year, 2020. And it seems like it declares, quote, human body activity associated with the task provided to a user may be used in a mining process of a cryptocurrency system. The body activity that Microsoft wants to mine includes radiation emitted from the human body, brain activities, body fluid flow, blood flow, organ activity, body movement such as eye movement, facial movement, and muscle movement, as well as any other activities that can be sensed and represented. And this is something you mentioned in your book. And I'm curious to hear a little bit more about this. It's just such a bizarre patent. And I'm thinking you were saying earlier that there could be a connection to COVID, or is that something you were mentioning before in that last response?
Well, the thing is, all the systems being put in place on grounds of our safety are systems that are data mining systems. They are surveillance systems. And that's why for those who think the next smart wear that'll monitor their pulse rate and then send signals, or a smartphone that'll always be on and will have all kinds of algorithms and applications that'll keep sending signals, they need to read this patent and then make the decision about how they see their own body and how they want to govern themselves. Because if they don't read these patents, they will be thinking, oh, I'm doing this to protect my health. And they'll walk right into the surveillance prison.
Thank you so much for bringing this up. That's something that we really need to hear. Now, Vandana, global society's fault lines are becoming more and more apparent, and this visibility is welcome after we've been calling for the rupture of these dystopian and exploitative systems. Yet this is a time of great uncomfort. And of course, there are those who point out that, you know, they've already been living in an apocalyptic world, which leads me to think about the multitude of emotions and thoughts and experiences our world family is holding. And I know this is overwhelming for many, making it difficult to think about where we should be orienting ourselves. In Oneness Versus the 1%, you share a quote from poet and philosopher Rabindranath Tagore, and it's, quote, contemporary Western civilization is built of brick and wood. It is rooted in the city, but Indian civilization has been distinctive in locating its source of regeneration, material and intellectual, in the forest, not in the city. India's best ideas have come where man was in communion with trees and rivers and lakes, away from the crowds, end quote. As someone who has found a life of purpose and dedication to the temperate rainforest, I really resonate so deeply with this quote. And as we come to a close, I wonder if you might share how, in a moment where so much is happening, where we're all feeling so much, how we might ground ourselves, our actions and aspirations in reference to the forest.
I think there are three ways in which we can and must ground ourselves in the forest. First, to return to the forest for lessons of democracy. And that's what Tagore has said in that quote, that we learn democracy from the forest, where everything is diverse and everything is interconnected. True democracy as coexistence of diversity and mutuality of diversity, I think, is the first. The second is to realize that the forest is not a wilderness that's doing nothing and should be wiped out and cut down for a mine or GMO soya in the Amazon or palm oil in Indonesia. But the forest is the heart of the planet and should be our heart and our mind too. The third, and this has been my life's dedication, industrial agriculture and Hitler's chemical tools moving into the farms through agrochemicals, agrotoxins, the pesticides, the herbicides, even the chemical fertilizers, that this created a monoculture and the destruction of the wilderness of the farm. In India, we protected it. And my work in Navdanya, which means nine seeds, is for diversity, not just the diversity we plant, but the diversity that grows when we plant non-violently. The other day on our farm, I just counted in one square foot 12 edible plants and medicinal plants that we hadn't sown, but are there to give us bounty and abundance. So, you know, wrap up the roundup and allow nature to thrive. And the fourth, very, very important part of this is we have to remember that we have a forest within. Our gut microbiome with 100 trillion microbes is a forest, and we have to nurture it. And we nurture it through the link that food provides between the earth in her diversity and our bodies with the gut diversity. When those two are in sync, there is health for the planet and there's health for our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, for my last question, Vandana, I wanted to bring up the total irresponsibility in which corporations handle life. You know, clearly is no surprise, especially from this conversation, behaving as if there's no sanctity to what we experience or witness during our time on Earth. And I think about this in context of geoengineering, which I might have mistakenly thought to have been pushed to the periphery, not that it was something that is still actively being pursued or being taken seriously, yet weather modification continues to be funded. So I'm wondering if you could speak to this a bit, and where does geoengineering currently stand?
Well, we just released the Gates report, and our etc. colleagues presented the latest on geoengineering. The research on it continues, and Bill Gates is a big driver. They call him the sugar daddy of geoengineering. Without his money, it would be very dead. He doesn't just fund these reckless experiments with the planet. He actually buys votes by spending public relations money to influence the UN outcome, both on geoengineering as well as on gene drives. So the report on the Gates to a Global Empire is available for free download on the Navdanya International website. And for anyone who wants to know more, both about more of Bill Gates than I've written in Oneness versus 1%, as well as geoengineering and the extinction technology of gene drives, please go visit the website of Navdanya International. And when we realize these powers are too big, that is when our powers must be unleashed in unity, in solidarity. And what I've done over the many years is when you bring 20 groups that are all victims together in one tribunal, I did a seed tribunal. We did a Monsanto tribunal in 2016. And that then makes people realize, well, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one. And then it becomes the unity of the earth and all the people who are victims of harm, whether they be farmers, whether they be consumers, whether they be cancer victims, whether they be farmers who committed suicide because of debt. All this becomes one problem. And corporations and the billionaires and the philanthro-imperialists like Bill Gates rest on having the public believe their story. That is why we must tell our stories. We don't have the media, the dominant media. We don't have it. But we do have communication with each other, like my conversation with you. And we must talk to each other and realize we are all in the same crisis. And we will all get out of it together in unity.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, Vandana. This has been medicine for my soul, as I'm sure for the listeners who are joining us.
Thank you, and stay strong, all of you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Wild podcast. The music you heard today was by John Newton, Lady Moon in the Eclipse, and G-Jaw. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Francesca Glasfell, and Melanie Younger.